This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
We've had seismic changes in the last decade, and we've adapted to them. But what comes next?
We really talk about autonomous business processes rather than just automating business processes.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. Our latest episode explores how to build a digital brain and future-proof your business. Vision to Value on Resilient Edge is available now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
The following advertisement feature is presented by GoTurkey. Most travelers only scratch the surface of Turkey. The real Turkey is found on a detour. Plan your next trip to southeastern Anatolia to witness a culinary crossroads, surprising history, and adrenaline-fueled mountain trails. The southeast of Turkey is home to what the country might be most famous for: food. In Gaziantep, taste the flavors that makes it a UNESCO-recognized creative city of gastronomy. Eat baklava in the home of baklava. Eat pistachios in the home of the pistachio. Hike up UNESCO-recognized Mount Nemrut, where history is larger than life, literally. Where giant statues were built by a king who wanted to be remembered for eternity. It worked, as his head is up there, set in stone, 2,000 years later. And take a tour around one of civilization's biggest mysteries, Göbekli Tepe. Nobody knows who built these stunning settlements. Historians predict it was built more than 11,000 years ago, before farming, the invention of the wheel. But somehow it was built. Who done it? If you want to get more from your holiday and skip the beach and crowds, take a detour to southeastern Anatolia and discover more about the world in Turkey.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room. You, me, top experts, plus 28 minutes equals enlightenment on a big subject. Today, the economy is stalling. One reason is labour shortages, and one reason for labour shortages is the over-50s dropping out of work. What can be done to entice them back into the workforce? Earlier this week, the IMF warned that the UK will be the weakest G7 economy this year. And one of the reasons given was the labour shortage here. And a large part of that seems to have been caused by over-50s who left the workforce during the pandemic and haven't returned. So why haven't older workers come back? And what can be done to change their minds? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at the scale of the problem. Joining me in the briefing room is Torsten Bell, Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation. Torsten Bell, if we look at the over-50s workforce now compared to the pre-pandemic period, what do the numbers show?
Well, the number will tell us that we've got fewer people working than we expected to have and that we had before the pandemic. We're talking about around 1 million people fewer, 900,000 fewer people working, more people who are economically inactive, and that can basically be thought as a third, a third, a third. So a third of those are the under 50s, a third of those are 50 to 65, and a third of those are over 65. And it probably is worth thinking about those groups differently.
I have to say, some of that's quite surprising. I'm surprised to find so much of that is really significantly older people.
Well, I think it is worth thinking a bit differently about the over 65s to the 50 to 64 year olds. If we look at the over 65s, what's going on is a long term trend that's going to continue, which is there are more of them, which you probably already knew. And there being more of them rather than fewer of them working that is doing the work in terms of the increased economic inactivity amongst the over 65s. Whereas the thing we're actually all focused on is people being less likely to be working than they were before the pandemic. And there the action is amongst the 50 to 64 year olds.
Right. We'll come on to a bit more of that in a moment. Now, we last looked in this programme at the workforce in the middle of 2021. Has the number of economically inactive over 50s gone up since then?
Overall, I'd say the picture is pretty much the same. I mean, we saw a small improvement in economic inactivity in the spring, but basically we have stayed steady, which makes us think that this is quite a lasting effect, at least on this cohort of over 50s.
Torsten, what about regional differences? Is the picture the same everywhere?
I think that is really important. I don't think it's had enough attention underneath the national story. So if you look at Scotland, for example, the good news is that the pandemic hasn't done a lot to increase economic inactivity. In fact, it hasn't done it in any of the devolved nations. The problem in Scotland isn't about the pandemic. The problem in Scotland is we had rising inactivity before the pandemic, particularly a big increase in the middle of the last decade. And that's to do with more older people, sicker people, increased disability that was going on in Scotland, plus increase in student numbers, which is also a good thing. So I think in Scotland, you've got a not a pandemic story, you've got a pre-pandemic story. Then if we step back and look at some of the English regions, I think it's worth distinguishing between two different trends. We've got increases in activity amongst older workers that are being driven by retirement. And they're more likely to be in the south of England. And then if we look at where ill health is driving the increase in inactivity, then we're heading towards northern regions, the northeast in particular. Actually, interestingly, the East Midlands stands out for having a bit of both. So you've got some retirements, happy inactivity, and you've got some less happy inactivity.
Okay, let's look at the jobs areas where there are shortages. Have they changed since we spoke in 2021?
Well, the big change since we last spoke is that the big surge in vacancies that happened as we reopened the economy after the pandemic has basically turned the corner. So there's still a lot of vacancies out there, but the hyper-hot labour market that people were worrying about back in the summer has basically started to fade. So the number of vacancies is falling, still very high, but it is falling.
In terms which areas would those be? Hospitality was the one that came to mind.
Yeah, so hospitality, but lots of public sectors. So like health and social care, still very large vacancies. Indeed, you'll hear that being discussed in the context of the strikes clearly, but you can see them, you know, professional and scientific technical roles too. So they're quite broadly felt. But yeah, they are still largely in the areas we discussed before.
Now, this is a tricky question, particularly when we consider that we're talking to a Radio 4 audience, quite a lot of whom are my kind of age, Torsten. Are there...
Prime age, as it's known.
Those of us in our prime. Are the type of jobs where there are the most vacancies the ones for which the over 50s are best suited?
Safer to let you answer. So if we look at where the people who have left employment into economic activity over the course of the pandemic, the large numbers are coming from higher paid roles, so professional, scientific, public administration roles, the public sector roles. There's a second thing which I think worth pondering, which is less about what's happened recently, but is about the big picture of our labour market, which is if we look at who does lower earning jobs, it's a U-shape. It's younger workers in their 20s and it's older workers. If you look at the proportion of workers of each given age who are in low-earning jobs, one of the longer-term trends is that lower-earning jobs have become more intensive over time. If you look at surveys going back to the 90s, it's lower earners that have seen an increase in work intensity. Higher earners have always had pretty intensive jobs, higher levels of stress, whereas lower earners used to be a lot more chilled at work. Now, that fits with broader patterns, levels of observation. Higher minimum wage puts more pressure on companies to sweat lower earning labour. So I think you have got to ask how much are lots of people who are previously doing higher earning jobs going to want to go into very intensive lower earning jobs. And that's where our labour market has gone over the course of the last 30 years.
Well, I guess you've also got to ask yourself how much older workers who've been used to those lower earning jobs want to maintain that degree of intensity.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do focus groups all the time with low earners. We were doing some about a month ago. People are very clear that one of the reasons they're working, say, part-time rather than full-time, particularly later in life, is because it would be absolutely exhausting to work. It's not just about a financial decision, it's a physical health decision.
Torsten Bell there with the what. Now for the why. And is it the same abroad? Mike Crowhurst is director at Public First, a research and policy consultancy. Mike Crowhurst, you've looked at data for the UK, USA and Germany, I think. What differences did you find when looking at why people were leaving the workforce in their 50s?
Well, we carried out a large-scale poll of adults over 50 across each of those three countries, looking at how people viewed work and what influenced their decision to retire. And what stood out really for the UK was the number of people who said that they had retired because they simply no longer wanted to work. That was the main reason people here gave for retiring, and it was much bigger as a driver than we found in other countries. About 35% of people here said they'd retired because they didn't want to work anymore, compared to only 25% in the USA and 15% in Germany. And we found that that trend had got bigger since the pandemic. So people here in the UK who've retired since then were more likely to say that they had done so because they didn't want to work anymore. And it does seem to be a post-COVID trend in a way that we haven't seen in other countries.
That's absolutely fascinating. Was this because we in Britain were less happy in our jobs than they were in other countries?
Yes, I think we found some evidence of that. So we asked people about how they feel about their current job, and less than 60% of people in the UK said that they liked it, compared to about 75% in the other two countries. And when we asked people about the words they associate with work, in the UK, they were much more likely to say negative words like tiring or boring than we found in the other countries. And when we followed this up with focus group work, we tend to find that when we speak to people, there is a bit of a sense that they are left behind by their employers, they're potentially not valued as much as people in those other countries feel.
Right. In other words, the fact that they were older and more experienced, in their view, made them feel less valued by the employer.
Yes, exactly. I think when we did a focus group in Germany, that sense of being valued and being quite prized by employers came through in a way that it didn't when we spoke to people in the UK.
That's very suggestive. Now, did the pandemic change people's attitudes towards early retirement here?
Yes. And again, that was something that we found particularly in the UK. So about 40% of the over 50s that we polled told us that the pandemic had made them rethink how they viewed work. And that was much higher than the rates that we saw in the US and Germany. And when we've spoken to people about this in our focus groups, I think what it's made people feel is that their priorities have changed. So they're now much more aware of not having as much time left. I think the pandemic has injected a bit of a sense of mortality, and that they really want to enjoy the time that they feel they do have. And those feelings do seem to be translating into decisions to retire. So about a fifth of people in the UK who've retired after COVID said that the pandemic played a role. That was double the rate that we saw in Germany.
Now, in addition to happiness and the questions of mortality, what were the other biggest considerations when making an early retirement decision? I think I'm mostly talking here about economic factors.
Yes, there's clearly a link with people feeling financially comfortable. In particular, we found a link with home ownership, and that was a really, really important factor in explaining the decision to retire early. Now, you might expect that to some extent, but in the UK, I think it's particularly pronounced because we have much higher rates of home ownership, but also because the pandemic seems to have opened up more of a divide in this country between people who own their homes and people that don't. So we found that homeowners in the UK were more than twice as likely as those in the USA, and actually four times as likely as those in Germany, to say that they felt better off as a result of the pandemic. And that higher level of financial comfort seems to be feeding through into them feeling like they can make a decision to retire if they want to. I think it's about that feeling of financial comfort. So people who own their own home, particularly if they own it outright, are much more likely to feel that they are financially secure and set up for the future. And also we found that looking ahead, around three quarters of people over 50 in the UK plan to leave work early, which is higher than we found in other countries.
Now, there's also some suggestion that as many as half of the over 50s who've left the workforce have done so due to some form of long-term sickness. So can we quantify the problem of ill health for early retirement?
Yes, we can. I think our analysis has suggested that that's probably not as much of an issue as has been suggested elsewhere. If you look at the data over time and how cohorts move through into their 50s, we actually found that people deciding to take early retirement or potentially having other reasons like needing to look after family were more important as reasons for retiring early than illness. And in fact, we found that just 16% of people aged 50 to 64 who had left work since 2019 gave long-term sickness or disability as their main reason for doing so. Interestingly, when we make the international comparison, people in the UK were the least likely of those three countries to say that they've been forced out of work due to a long-term health condition, quite a lot less likely than people in Germany or the USA. Where we did find an important thing with ill health is in getting people back into work. So if you look at the flows of people who've been off work because of sickness back into work since the start of the pandemic, those flows have slowed down quite significantly. And one reason for that could be that people feel like they can't get the healthcare that they need. So again, when we looked at our polling, although people in the UK were less likely to say they'd retired because of ill health, they were much more likely to say that they couldn't get the healthcare they needed. So there may be something going on there about people who are out of work not being able to get the healthcare they need and therefore not being able to get back into the labour market.
Right. Now, we're coming on to solutions in a moment, Mike, but given there's talk of tax breaks for older workers and there's a budget coming up, what does your research tell you about whether these are likely to work?
So I think it's something that could potentially work. Sweden has run a scheme which is similar to this for slightly older workers, so people in their 60s, and that has been shown to have an impact, particularly for people who are lower paid. But I think the important point is that it's probably unlikely to be a silver bullet. The big challenge for the government with this group is that quite a lot of them have retired early because they want to leave work and because they feel financially able to do so. And that would suggest that a tax break is probably not likely to be the thing that is going to keep them in the labour market longer or tempt them to come back.
Mike Crowhurst. Now, the how. As in, how do we convince older people to rejoin the workforce? With me now are Bea Boileau, a research economist in the retirement, saving and ageing sector at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, James Kirkup, director of the Social Market Foundation, and Tony Wilson, director of the Institute for Employment Studies. Tony Wilson, if I could start with you, what are the government doing to encourage over 50s to come back to work currently?
Well, so far, the government's really doing very little to encourage over 50s back to work. So for over 50s who are out of work, some can get access to employment support through Job Centre Plus, but actually it's very few of those who are out of work are eligible because eligibility for Job Centre Plus support tends to be limited to those who are actively seeking work, who are treated as being unemployed. And that's only about 1 in 10, 1 in 15 of all over 50s are out of work. For other over 50s, there's actually very little support available at all beyond looking after yourself, beyond looking looking online or looking in the newspapers or so on. So no, the so far is very little. There's a lot of talk about future support, but very little being done so far.
Tony, can you just remind us what Job Centre Plus is?
Yeah, so Job Centre Plus is our employment service, but mainly actually it focuses on monitoring compliance that people are meeting their conditions for benefit receipt. So for the most part, that's monitoring people who are required to look for work. And as I say, that's a really small fraction of all those who are out of work. It also engages employers, vacancy handling and trying to help to fill vacancies. But it doesn't tend to provide support to people who don't meet those fairly narrow criteria. And that's more than 90% of the over 50s who are out of work don't meet those criteria of actively seeking work through and claiming universal credit.
James, I read that the government is suggesting something called a midlife MOT. What is that?
Well, this isn't actually something new. It started in the private sector with Aviva, the insurance company. They started realising that they were losing employees over 50 and they wanted to keep them. A midlife MOT is essentially you sit down when you're in your 40s or 50s, you sit down with an advisor who talks to you about your pension savings to date and your future plans and says, what do you want when you retire? When do you want to retire? Do you need to work longer? Do you need to save more? Let's have a review of your situation and think about whether or not your work and savings plans are adequate to the future needs and hopes you have. So government actually been sort of trying to roll this out, to offer this through Job Centre Plus and other sources for a couple of years now on a fairly small scale. But it's one of these ideas that's been thrown to the pot as being one of the possible answers to this wider problem.
Can I just ask you, why wouldn't a midlife MOT lead just as many people to decide that they don't want to work?
Well, simply because a lot of people don't have enough in their pension to retire in the condition and style they'd like to have. I mean, it tends to be that when people sit down with an informed advisor or guide who talks them through the numbers, they come to the conclusion that, you know what, actually, if I want to have a decent standard of retirement, I'd better work more and save more.
Bea, let's look at a non-financial aspect of this. Could you remind us how big a factor in the problem we're talking about long-term sickness is? And if there is a jump, is it purely COVID-related?
We don't find that more people are leaving employment and moving directly into inactivity for health-related reasons. But what we do see is that among people who've been out of the labour force for quite a while, so for 5 years or more, increasing numbers of those people are now saying that the main reason they're not returning to the workforce is because of long-term sickness. And this kind of increasing sickness is something that we see in other trends in the UK in general. So, for example, the increasing number of disability benefit applications. And some of this is going to be COVID-related. So, to some extent, long COVID might play a role. But it's unlikely that that can explain the whole picture, because if that's the case, why does the UK look so different from other countries in Europe, which have seen long COVID but haven't seen these similar trends in inactivity?
James, what are the government suggesting in terms of overhauling sickness and disability benefit legislation that might impact upon this situation?
Well, again, we don't exactly know at the moment because there's lots of briefings and suggestions doing the rounds. We do know that there is a white paper on health and disability coming later in the year, and it's been suggested that that paper will overhaul the way people are assessed when they are receiving benefits to support them with illness and disability related conditions. The effect of that would be that you would if you're out of work receiving those benefits and you get a job, at the moment you are assessed to see whether or not you can keep some or all of that benefit. It looks like that assessment might be removed, allowing more people who are receiving those support payments to keep those support payments as and when they move back into work. That's quite, I mean, again, we don't know that's definitely happening. We do know that the Labour Party have effectively committed themselves to a similar position. So there's probably consensus around that.
And do we imagine that that alone would have a significant effect, or is it a marginal effect but desirable?
I think it's unlikely to be the whole answer, but it's a good thing in and of itself, and so should be pursued regardless of the magnitude of the effect it has on the problem we're talking about here.
Now, B, you might have thought that with the group of people we're discussing, childcare was no longer an issue, but would that be right?
Not entirely, no. So we don't see a growth in people leaving the workforce for caring responsibilities among this group. We don't see that the levels of caring responsibilities have gone up. That said, there are still a significant fraction of over 50s who aren't in the workforce because they're taking care of children or even grandchildren, for example. And it's true that improvements to childcare might persuade some of those people to return to the workforce.
Tony, let's talk about pensions. One of the factors which has been put into play here has been the pension freedoms that were brought in, which a lot of our listeners will be familiar with. How big a role has that played, do you think, in people feeling they can leave the workforce?
We don't really know how far it's driven the increases during the pandemic, but there is a fair bit of evidence that pension wealth is a pretty strong predictor of when people leave work. So people who have more pension savings are more likely to leave work earlier. People who don't are more likely to leave work later. I mean, that's part of the rationale as well, you know, with raising state pension age is that people will stay in work. There's a real challenge here, though, of course, because people who are on lower incomes who are having to work later when state pension age has the most effect, and people on higher incomes that are more able to retire earlier. And we see this actually in the data on people who've left work since the pandemic. So the ONS had some good survey evidence on this out in the autumn, and this showed that those aged in their 50s and early 60s, about half were supporting themselves from private pension income. And that was the most common way that people were supporting themselves financially.
Is it the case that actually this is, in a bad way, a self-correcting problem, because final salary pensions have pretty much disappeared, defined benefit pensions are becoming much less common, and therefore in the future, people simply won't have the money that the current generation have to allow them to retire early?
So the kinds of changes that we're seeing to people's pension provision as they move into retirement are really quite slow moving, but it's true that over time we're going to see fewer people with big defined benefit pensions. That said, where pension freedoms really apply is for people with defined contribution pots. So if anything, we're going to see more people being able to use the freedoms offered by pension freedoms to access smaller but more widespread defined contribution pots to perhaps tide them over until state pension age if they're wanting to afford, in some sense, an early retirement.
All right, so future poverty is not going to solve this problem for us. Let's turn to the question of employers, James. The government wants over 50s back in work, but do employers, brackets, really?
Some certainly do. And if you go back to that, the evidence we've got about what is it that would persuade the over 50s to come back to work, probably the number one reason, the thing they're most interested in, is not money, it's flexibility. They tend to say that what would interest them coming back is the ability to work flexibly, to vary their shifts, to fit their work around their other commitments. So that is the most important thing that employers can do, and some are doing it. I mean, if you go back to your point about midlife MOTs, that was originally started in the private sector. So certainly bigger employers who are aware of the need to bring back the skills and productivity of older workers, lots of them are flexing their practices to try and bring back, you know, these workers. But it's a harder thing for the SMEs, the small and medium-sized enterprises that are the majority of employers in the country. So I mean, I think, yes, they do want them to come back. The scope they feel they've got at the moment may be limited.
But this is where I play the question that we touched on earlier in the programme, which is the feeling amongst older workers here in Britain that they are unhappier at work than people are in other countries. So I'm going to ask you, Bea, it strikes me that there's a bit of a disconnect, isn't there? The government are pushing the state retirement age up, and yet there's this feeling in some organisations, when you hit your mid-50s, you're really on your way out. Is that fair?
It's not immediately clear to me that the rise in inactivity we've seen has been a result of employers making this active choice to get rid of their over 50 population rather than some over 50s making the choice to retire. Now, perhaps that's coming from employers not knowing exactly how to support their over 50 workforce, not offering the necessary flexibilities. But it could easily be over 50s making more of an active decision themselves rather than employers deciding to get rid of them and deciding those aren't productive members of their workforce.
James.
I think a concern with some justification is that it is hard to get into a job that suits you when you're of that sort of age. And this is, again, this is slightly anecdotal evidence that we're exploring at the Social Market Foundation, that, you know, linking to the point about flexibility, it's relatively easy to get flexibility when you're in a job and you've been there for a long time, you have good standing with your employer. It's hard to apply for and get a new job with flexibility. And that, we think, could be one of the big barriers here, that lots of jobs are not advertised as flexible from the start, that there's not just, there's just that sort of mindset posture among employers to think, how can we, from the start, make this employment one that accommodates people who are older, who might need flexibility, who might have different needs. So I think that's a sort of, there's probably a gap, an attitudinal barrier there that's making it harder for some employees over 50, ex-employees over 50, to get back into work.
Tony, let's look at one of the obvious problems here, which is the familiarity of the over 50s with new technology. Is that a problem?
Well, I'm not so sure that it is, actually. I think it's certainly the fact that technology is changing how we work in, you know, across a range of the industries that we do. But actually, we need to get away from the sort of stereotype that people over 50 who are in the workforce don't use technology all the time in their jobs. I think the challenges for over 50s are pretty similar to the challenges for any of us in changing jobs. If we have to change job completely, if we're moving into a new industry or a new occupation, then there's going to be new things we'll have to learn. And this comes back to, you know, how employers view that investment. And we've had, you know, for decades, really, employers haven't really had to think too hard about investment in skills training for people who take up their jobs, because we've had, you know, a lot of labor supply, and employers have been able to kind of fill their vacancies and not have to often invest significantly in that support. And I think that's going to change. I would say, though, I mean, we said earlier about over 50s might be more likely to leave as well. Actually, I think over 50s, there is some evidence on this, are more likely to stay with their employer. So I think actually the investment in somebody who's in their 50s might be money better spent than somebody who might be in their early 20s and might, you know, stay for 2 years and move on. So I think it's definitely a challenge, but I think it's possibly not as big a challenge as it might have been like 20 years ago.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that employers would be better focusing on the over 50s who are still in work rather than trying to encourage those who've left to come back, because that's going to be a bit of a forlorn task. James, you're shaking your head.
No, I think we should try and do both. I mean, certainly the people who have left, a fair chunk of them, could be half, could be more, have indicated in the best survey evidence we've got that they are open to returning to work if there is a flexible, accommodating form of work that they can do. So it's not a done deal for them.
B.
I think I would focus more on the flow than on persuading people to return. I think it's true that in some survey evidence, people say that they would consider returning. But when we look at evidence from the labour force survey at whether people don't have a job and actively want a job, they're just not searching for one, almost all of the growth has been in people who say they don't want a job as well as are not searching for one. And retirement, we know, tends to be a pretty persistent condition. In pre-pandemic evidence, only about 5 to 10% of people who've retired ever return to work. Of course, it's true that we're currently seeing a cost of living crisis, we're seeing mortgage costs go up. All of these things, as well as other reforms that the government might make, might persuade some people to return to work. But I think that as the government, I'd be focusing more on how to persuade people moving into their 50s and 60s to remain in work.
Tony, those are two very slightly different answers, which is absolutely fine. Can you reconcile them for us?
I'm worried I'm going to offer a slightly different answer again, which is that I think for those who've left work during the pandemic, they have overwhelmingly left to retirement, it seems. And for people who retire in their 50s, they simply aren't going to come back. So, you know, I very much agree with B that if we look at what's changed in the pandemic and the retirement increases, I don't think that's where we should be focusing. But I think actually the bigger issue is focusing on what hasn't changed and focusing on those who are already out of work and are over 50. And most people out of work and over 50 haven't retired. They're out of work because of a long-term health condition. They're out of work because they're caring. They're out of work for other reasons. And I think there's a risk that too much of the debate focuses on those who've left and not enough on how we support those who are already out of work to come back in. And ill health is a really good example of that, because that hasn't been a factor driving exits from work in the pandemic, but it's a huge factor, I think, in reducing the number of people coming back into the labour force. So how we increase employment support for people out of work needs to be right, I think, at the heart of what the government does. And I don't think that's an early retirement problem. I think that's fundamentally how we help people with health conditions, care and responsibilities and out of work for other reasons.
Tony Wilson there with Bea Boileau and James Kirkup. My thanks to them and to Torsten Bell and Mike Crowhurst. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Daniel Gordon. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one on whether we can colonise the moon, the one on whether there are any quick fixes for the NHS, and the one on how we deal with an ageing world.
Are you confused about why your mortgage rate is going up? Unsure of what causes inflation, or befuddled over what GDP stands for? I've got the perfect podcast for you. I'm Tim Harford, and in my new Radio 4 podcast, Understand the Economy, I'm taking you back to basics. I'm going to explain all the complex financial terms you're hearing in the news as clearly as I can. Inflation, interest rates, growth, bonds, banks, I'll explain it all. Search for Understand the Economy, available now on BBC Sounds.
The following advertisement feature is presented by GoTurkey. Ever thought about taking a detour? Turkey is known for its breathtaking beaches and mouth-watering kebabs. But did you know it's also a hub of ancient histories, a verdant land for produce and wine, and home to Michelin-star cuisine that surprises and delights? What more could you ask for? Look no further than the Aegean region of Turkey. It has it all. Discover culinary excellence in Urla, İzmir by sampling local produce in restaurants along the way. Experience history in Teos, an ancient Ionian city in Seferisa, where they loved a good glass of wine so much they built temples in honour of Dionysus, the god of wine and theatre himself. And feel the sand beneath your feet along the Aegean's stunning beaches. Or maybe the wind through your hair, kite surfing along the Alecata coastline. Turkey isn't just about the sun lounger, it's about the adrenaline. If you thought you had Turkey all figured out, try out the Turkegean lifestyle.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier- und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.